the goal of communicative leadership is very much in keeping with the goal of every good corporation, and that is to gain and gather the license to operate from all the stakeholders.
Welcome on the Wait and Speak podcast. I'm your host, Raquir Wait. In this episode, I speak with Emilio Galli-Zugaro. We discussed communicative leadership, specifically how to gain credibility and trust with your stakeholders, the fork test as a leadership analogy, and how leaders can practice communicative leadership. Without further ado, here's the interview. Emilio, welcome on the Wait and Speak podcast.
Hello, good morning.
Emilio, it's wonderful to have you on the podcast today. And we're here to discuss leadership, specifically communicative leadership. And you've published a book on the topic. And I think maybe that's a good starting point. I have a good few questions I want to get through today and get your insights on. But firstly, you co-authored this book, The Listening Leader, with your daughter on communicative leadership. And what was the inspiration for this collaboration? And how did you approach the project, taking it from idea to publication?
Well, I have four kids, and my oldest one, Clementina, is a psychologist by education. And when she was a child, we already started discussing things about work life and so forth. So we had established a very nice conversation across the generations. And when I thought about writing down the learnings of my professional career, the mistakes I did and what I learned from them, and the best I could possibly squeeze out of myself and of research on leadership, I discussed this with my daughter, and suddenly it came to me how wonderful it would be to write the book together with her for several reasons. One, for the pure bliss of spending time with a person I love. The second, for providing the readers with a different perspective, not only of an elderly white man, but also of a young, engaged woman with a different professional background and a different optique and perspective on things. And I think that this cooperation enriched the contents of the book. And Clementina worked about the whole thing in a totally different manner from what I did. For example, when we were tackling specific issues, she challenged her community over social media on what they thought of things. She did little polls and so forth. So she didn't only bring her own perspective, but I would say the one of her generation and with a very global community she's a part of.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think that collaboration and different perspectives definitely come through in the book. And to set the scene before we go into more detail, you touch on two key elements that set the context for leaders in the book, specifically the loss of trust in companies and the role of social media. Could you tell us more how these factors influence the scene within which leaders have to operate?
These are really two important changes over the last 20 years. In the past, the establishment, let's say the leading establishment in the world, I'm speaking about politics, I'm speaking about business, science, NGOs and media, had a ground noise of credibility. This has faded over the last 20 years. You can look at many reasons why this is the case, the failure of Enron and Omnicom and many other companies who collapsed. The loss of trust in governments and the media, the raise of questions about fake news and manipulation. There are many reasons, but they really touch upon leadership, because in previous times the CEO could claim something and you would normally believe him or her. This is not the case any longer. The most trusted source, north, south, east, west on this planet, is the average citizen. And if you look at the business world, the least trusted source is the website, then comes advertising and PR, and there's nothing new under the sky. That PR and marketing aren't as trustworthy as the other sources is quite a common phenomenon. But the two new things that came about and that have been observed by many analysts and researchers is first that the credibility of the CEO is at the same level as the credibility of the PR person. And that is the first piece of news. And that is really diminishing the impact of CEOs' voices. And the second interesting thing about the loss of trust is that the most trusted source is the average employee. So Susie Smith from the controlling department is twice as credible as the CEO. And this, of course, is a huge challenge for leadership because you need to make sure that all of your staff, all of your stakeholders that are now turning into more important sources than yourself are being well informed and are on the message and are believers in the cause. And the second big change that has occurred over the last 20 years is that this average citizen who is the most trusted source is suddenly empowered by the media. In previous times, you needed to have a journalist or a politician, for example, to address a complaint against a bad service of a company or mishappenings in the public world. And the journalist was checking this, or the politician would look at it and then make a parliamentary inquiry about it. Now everyone has a smartphone. Everyone has access to social media. And every single person can voice their concern and potentially do harm to corporations or enhance corporations' power. And this is a new phenomenon, which again makes sure that you need to act very much in keeping with what you say, because everybody is there to control whether you're really acting upon it, and you can't fool the public any longer. So these are two big challenges to leadership.
Definitely. And with that context, Emilio, we've talked about communicative leadership, but what does it really mean, and what are some of the benefits of following such a leadership style of being a communicative leader with that context that you just gave there?
The goal of communicative leadership is very much in keeping with the goal of every good corporation, and that is to gain and gather the license to operate from all the stakeholders. Let's just cluster them into four big groups, even though there are many more. The customers, the employees, the investors, and society at large. Every single one of them can take away the license to operate from a company by voicing their concerns, their doubts, by questioning the business model and everything. And therefore, communicative leadership is a way to make sure that you are not only well informed about what the stakeholders think and demand from a corporation, but also that you engage in a dialogue. Because what we know is that to give a license to operate, there are different degrees. The first thing is you need to be informed. You need to know what's going on. You need, as an employee and as a customer, you want to know where this company stands. But then comes the communication part, and that is the ability by a company to truly listen to what the stakeholders expect from this company. And we may deepen that further. I'm not going to do that now. But basically, it is important for the corporation to truly listen to what the stakeholders expect, and then make sure that what they listen to is being put into the strategy of the company, changing the strategy and the behavior of the company in order to comply with these expectations. But this is not enough. In order to strengthen the bond with the stakeholders, it is important to enable them. It's just one example. If you find a ketchup bottle and it says it has 50% less sugar, this is not enabling the customer. What does it mean to have 50% of what? And is the amount of sugar still in the bottle still dangerous for the health of the person for diabetes or not? So enabling the stakeholders means taking them serious, means leveraging their strength, means understanding their motivations, and means to make sure that they can be on eye level with the corporation. And finally, you need, that's the most difficult part for many, many managers, but not for leaders, not for true leaders, is to empower the stakeholders. Because imagine yourself as a customer of a company where you feel that something is going wrong with the service. You tell the company, you're able to entertain a good dialogue with this company, and then the company changes their behavior. And this shows that they're giving you power. Your voice is being heard. And this creates a bigger, stronger bond with the company. You feel you own this company. It is part of an ownership which gives a better license to operate. And to make this come about is what communicative leadership is about.
That's an excellent summation, Emilio. And as part of this, I think you mentioned enabling stakeholders, empowering stakeholders, but you also talk about, obviously, trust. We just started off talking about trust, and I think gaining credibility and trust with your stakeholders is obviously a key aspect of communicative leadership. And in the book as well, you refer to certain commandments of trust that leaders can follow. Can you tell us more about some of these examples leaders can consider to build trust and credibility with stakeholders?
Yes, without going through all the points, let's just look at the inception. I'm teaching leadership at the University in Munich, and at the chair where I teach, there was a young assistant wanting to do a PhD thesis on trust. A very nice man, Andreas. He made a good career in marketing afterwards, and he wrote up this book, of course, according to the principles of academia. And it turned out to be a 350 pages long scientific book that I truly couldn't understand. It was so complicated. And I said, well, Andreas, let's translate it into common language. And when we did so, I was sort of surprised that these commandments of trust, these laws to establish and reestablish trust, reminded me much more of our grandmothers and their wisdom and their common sense. And I'll give you some examples. Well, the first one is you have to lead by example. And that is something that sounds very simple, but you cannot preach certain behavior and not act accordingly. There was one case where a CEO had to announce a very difficult turnaround at his company, and he had a big town hall meeting, and he had to announce that many thousands of jobs would be shed, and that we would all need to tighten our belts, roll up our sleeves, and go through this very difficult time, saving money, looking at costs, and trying to save the company. Now, for the bad coincidences that sometimes fate has with us, he was just leaving for a weekend to celebrate the 18th birthday of his daughter, something wonderful to do. He went to the general airport terminal to board his corporate jet, and his daughter was waiting there. And the pilot, as a gesture of attention to this daughter, served caviar and a little champagne bottle to start the celebrations. And the daughter, as many of our kids do, just took a selfie and posted it on social media saying, Saint-Tropez waits for me. I'm going to celebrate and have a party. Now, this was seen by many people, among them lots of employees who had just heard that you know, it was time to tighten their belts. You can imagine that this CEO lasted only for a couple of days. He couldn't hold his job any longer because he didn't act as an example. It's unfortunate. It's a sad story for the daughter, but this is something you have to be mindful of. And this is just one example. Another important thing to know to establish and reestablish trust is that trust is made of a triangle that is made of three corners. One is integrity, the other is motivation, and the third is competence. Now imagine I worked in insurance for many years. You're talking to your insurance broker and you want to, you have $100,000 and you want to put them away for your old age provision. And this person is highly competent and is strongly motivated to make the best of your money. But this guy was in jail for many years for fraud. His integrity is highly questionable. You would not trust this person. Or imagine another corner falling away. This person is a person of high integrity. You know her because of her work in the parish, and she's also very competent. But then she asks you, what? You have $100,000, and you trust those crooks of insurance, asset management, and banks. Do you have a mattress? Why don't you hide this money in your mattress? Well, this person is not really motivated, and she doesn't help me with my case. Or the third case, you have a person with a high integrity and a strong motivation who is totally puzzled when you ask about an annuity product or an ETF fund, and she says, what is it? And she looks up at her handbook. She's not competent. So you cannot build trust if you don't have these three cornerstones. So we could go on and on, but there are a couple of rules I'd like to highlight because they are really important. One is also the fact that we have to be able to admit our mistakes and stand by to our mistakes. And you can look it up in a nice YouTube video of Mr. Toyota, one of the family members of the family owning the Toyota car manufacturing company, that after some cases of accidents that occurred in the US, and it's still not clear whether they occurred because of failures of Toyota or of the drivers, but he, in a truly convincing and moving way, apologizes for whatever has been done wrong by his company, causing harm to customers and society. If you're not able to admit mistakes, people will not be able to reestablish trust with you. Or another thing that is also very difficult to accept for managers, I always asked, do I like investigative journalists? Do I adore state prosecutors serving us subpoenas? Do I adore the internal audit department and compliance rules? No, I don't. And they were really a pain in the neck for many managers in the past years. But we need them. They're important. Because if we didn't act accordingly, that is the reason why we need independent controls. And we need to tackle that. We need feedbacks and controls. And if you want, I'd like to end with a big challenge, especially if you work in global corporations where you have people from many different backgrounds. You have Christians, you have Jews, you have Muslims, you have Buddhists, you have Hindus, you have atheists. And how do you set rules of values? You can't use the Old Testament, which would appeal to Muslims, Jews, and Christians, but not necessarily to the rest of the world. So one of the probably the most important rule is treat others as you'd like to be treated. And I might illustrate that with an example from how we at our company, which was the largest insurance and asset management company of the world, how we selected the people poised for top management jobs. And how this worked was the best kept secret in our corporations. And I can now reveal it because they have changed it, and so we can speak about it. Now imagine you're a manager, you're like 30 years old, you've had your first or second important management experience, and you lead a group of people, and then you suddenly get a call from the PA of the CEO. The CEO is somebody you haven't met. He or she might be five or six layers above you, the big, big boss. And she's calling you and says, well, Rekker, you are invited for 2 or 3 days at our farm in Upper Bavaria. If you have a partner or a spouse, bring her or him along and spend 3 days. And these are the dates. Please note them down. We're expecting you. You get some logistic details. Bye-bye. And there you sit, totally puzzled. What's going on? What is this invitation? Who's going to be there? And you ask your colleagues, and nobody has gotten an invitation of this kind. And they say, I don't know. And then suddenly you meet the old corporate fat cat at the coffee machine with the gray hair. He said, oh, Rekker, you've been invited to the fork test. And you would say, what? The fork test? Yes, yes. You'll be there and you'll have, you know, lunch or dinner with the top shots. And make sure you behave well because they're going to look at how you behave at the table and they will decide whether you are poised for a bigger job. So You nervously Google etiquette rules. You tell your spouse how she or he should be dressed, and you're quite nervously engaging into 3 days, mindful of not putting the knife in your mouth, but only the fork. And you would spend 3 days with wellness and trekking and so forth, nothing special happening. And you would have the final dinner with five tables. At each table, there would be one of the top managers of the executive board and five talents with their partners. You would have a nice, good evening with a very nice meal. And then you'd be sent to bed. Now comes the part that was kept secret from everyone and that I can now reveal. After the dinner, not only the five top shots sat together to discuss every single participant of that dinner and of these 3 days, but all of the house staff, the security people, the waitress, the cleaning lady, the gardener, everybody who's been interacting with those people for 3 days, and every one of them had the voice and the veto on these people. And if you had treated them despondently or arrogantly during these 3 days, you would have no chance to pass this test. And I think this is very telling, because if you're a corporation dealing with millions of customers and employees, and you're not acting in a fair and balanced way with everybody, just mindless of whether they're powerful or not, you're not poised for good leadership.
Yes, that's really an excellent analogy and case study, Emilio, for leaders to think about. And I think you gave excellent examples there. And I think the one point is lead by example and, you know, treat others as you want to be treated. Those are excellent principles to practice as a leader. And Emilio, then building on our discussion, in your book, you provide a bigger framework for leaders to consider in terms of developing their skills as communicative leaders. Can you tell us more about those principles that you discuss in the book in terms of a framework and how you can go about developing yourself as a communicative leader?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say everybody gifted with goodwill, a sparkle of intelligence and the ambition to succeed can learn these things with humility. That is very important, and not with the sense that just a good university degree will provide you with all the skills. Now, the first one is how we address our stakeholders, how we speak to our stakeholders. This is about information. We have to learn to be clear, not to use technical language and expert gobbledygook. We have to be understandable by our people and using plain language. The other thing that is important for information, be quick. Well, if you decide on a Monday and you inform about your decision on a Monday, 1 week or 1 month later, the time between the decision and the announcement is what we call times of rumors and speculations. Because people will know that the board has gathered and there would be some decisions, but they don't know what it is. And so they start thinking. They've seen Joe coming out of the meeting with a long face, and they say, oh, Joe, IT boss, has clearly been defeated. The new IT plan has not been decided upon. And you know, Joe is going to be fired or whatever. And maybe Joe had toothache that day, and that's why he had a long face. So instead of making rumors come about, make sure you inform your stakeholders very quickly after the decision. Another very important thing is we remember facts, we remember figures, but what we remember most is good stories. So make sure you're able to craft stories that are in keeping with the message you want to convey, that are true, that are real examples. I'll just give you an example. If you want to claim that your company is developing people, well, every company claims that. From the mafia to the KGB to every company in between, look at their websites, we develop our people. Now, this is just a statement. It may be wrong, it may be right. Now, in order to convey that information, you may give the example of Susan. Susan was a student when she first had an apprenticeship with our company. Then she finished her studies. We hired her in the sales department. She started to be a real superstar in selling. Then we promoted her to a manager. And then she had a burnout. And she was sick for 6 months. And then she came back and she told her boss that she doesn't feel ready for management and that it's too much of a burden. But her boss, Susan, one of our best leaders, told her, no, I'm going to support you. I'm going to be your mentor. You're going to go to a corporate university and learn these things. You've got to practice them. I'm going to be at your side. And now she is a member of the board in charge of sales. Now, that's a story. That's a good story that you can remember much better than just the phrase developing our people. Now, you can even make it better. Let her tell the story. That makes it clearer, truer, and so forth. So if you're mindful of these couple of rules, you will be able to provide good information. The problem is most managers think that information is communication. That is not the case. They normally use the word for communication for the case where they decide something and then they tell the PR person, now communicate. That's not what communication is about. Zeno from Elea, a philosopher from 2,500 years ago, said it in a wonderful way. He said, it's not a coincidence that we have two ears and one mouth in order for us to listen twice as much as we speak. So communication is about the interaction, is a dialogue, while information is a monologue. So the first thing that a manager needs to master is a good way to inform his or her stakeholders. But then comes the communication. And the communication is not only listening and just sitting in the lotus position and let the facts that we've listened to just pass by. No, we have to take them in to the organization and make sure that they transform our organization so that we have to bring them to the bodies who can decide, to the strategy, to the C-level, so that they learn and that they change. And to make sure that this happens, and it's not just a claim, there are a couple of crutches that I suggest, of tricks. The first is have clear performance indicators, KPIs, not complicated stuff. What I like, for example, as a KPI for customers is Net Promoter Score, which is the question, would you recommend this product or service to your friends and family from 0 to 10? This is a clear message that is conveyed to the company, and make sure that this message reaches the top. So clear KPIs, or the same goes for engagement for employees. Would you recommend this employer to friends and family? And figure out an engagement index. Then comes the second thing that is important about communication, the reporting. Just imagine you are a good customer or engaged and enthusiastic customer of an airline. I am of Lufthansa, for example. Now, if I read the FT or the Wall Street Journal with a story after their annual report of their profits and dividends and maybe layoffs and so forth, I'm not interested at all in all these things. As a customer, I'm much more interested in other things. I'm interested whether Lufthansa is more punctual than other airlines or not, whether they had more accidents and they're safer of other than other airlines or not, whether as a 6-foot man, I can sit in the economy class without destroying my knees, whether I get sick of their catering on board. These are the things that matter. So we have to get used to report about our companies according to the stakeholders. Well, think of somebody who wants to apply for a job at an employer. Yes, the profits are important. But as a young woman, I want to know how many women are in leadership positions in this company. And I would like to have the percentage, the numbers. And if you claim that you develop your people, how many of your managers were internally recruited and promoted, and how many were recruited from outside world, so that I can understand what are my odds to grow into this organization and many other things. So make sure that your reporting is looking not only at the investor, as normal reports do, but also at employees or potential and future employees and present employees, as well as customers and the society at large. And then that leads to the fourth point, because we'll, before we leave the point in communication, which is governance. Now, this might also lead into a power question, but just think of the governance. The only stakeholder represented in the governance in most countries in the world is the shareholder. In the board, you have representatives of the investors. That's fine. That's good, because investors need to have a payoff for their investments, and that is guaranteed by the power they get in the governance. But that is not enough. And I'm living in Germany right now, and here I learned about the power of the German governance system, which has a two-tier board system. The supervisory board, which is the top organism of the company, the top body of the company, and who has the task to supervise the executive board and to appoint the board members, is made 50% of the members are representatives of the stakeholder, of the shareholders. The other 50% are representatives of the employees. And so representatives of the simple employees and also trade unions appoint the CEO. And by giving them this governance role, you can make sure that the interests of the employees are taken care of. And this can be done with customers as well. Good companies, Federal Express and many others, have a customer board where the customers are selected or invited to join the board and give feedback to the company. And very good companies have ESG boards, environmental societal governance, where the interests of society are respected. What is the environmental impact of my company on carbon footprint? How are we treating our employees according to diversity and inclusion to gather and garner the best performance? And what are we doing about a good governance? Do we have controls, checks and balances? I don't want to further go into that. I think what is clear is that a good information and a good listening are the basis for communicative leadership before we come to other two areas. You know, next is about enabling your stakeholders. And there are some things that we simply have to know from what research has brought to us before and in the past years. For example, and the first thing we have to know, if it is about enabling, how do people learn? Many of these things have been already sketched out by Aristoteles, also 2,500 years ago. But now we know from research that almost 70% of what we learn by doing it, by practicing it. So if we want to allow a good employee to grow in the organization, give her the opportunity to practice this. Make sure there is a holiday substitution of a bigger job that she gets and she can practice that. Give her tasks to accomplish. The second most important source for learning is relationships, peers, your alumni network from the university, your mentors, the teacher who helped you in high school, your friends that you meet not only for doing sports, but then when you sit to have a beer or an Aperol spritz, you discuss things in respect of your working life. So coaching and mentoring are very good sources of learning in the relationship field. And only 10% of our learning is what most of the people think is the most important part, which is academic and theoretical learning. It is only 10%. So if we know how people learn, we can know how to enable people. Another important thing we need to know is that the power of strength. Now, we've been coming from let's say, a century of human resources practices, which were highly inspired by psychoanalysis. And psychoanalysis, which was a breakthrough in humanity, was born studying a disease. Freud looked at hysteria. And psychoanalysis basically looks at how to heal psychological diseases. Now, this led us in HR practices and companies to look at the weaknesses of our people, of our staff. So when you had a performance review, your boss might tell you, look, Emilio, you've done these things okay, but you really need to become punctual. You really need to learn more about figures and make sure that they add up in the correct way. And this leading by weaknesses, we found out, is not the most effective way to lead people. Positive psychology in the last 30 years has found out that leveraging strength is far more powerful than trying to mend weaknesses. We have a gap of roughly 60% between the two techniques. If you manage people by looking at their weaknesses and trying to mend them, you reach an average underperformance of roughly 25%. If you manage your people by making sure that they strengthen their strengths and they bring them to bear, you get an average overperformance of 35%. So it has an impact of overall on the overall performance of the company if you make the creative person act out on her creativity instead of forcing her to be punctual at the meetings. Yes, that may be a flaw, but if you're really interested to get the most potential out of this person, you might figure out ways where she doesn't even have to attend the meetings and you spend time with her and she shares her creativity with you. And then if you're punctual at the meeting, you can share that with others. Just to make a very banal, stupid example. And the third thing that we need to know in order to enable our people is to understand that how to use the best levers to do that. Now, we come from an era at the beginning of the industrial age where the incentivation and the motivation was basically a carrot and sticks. So if you're good, you get more money. If you're bad, you're being fired. So this works for the low-level jobs. If you do a job just to pay the mortgage or pay the rent, you don't like it, and it's just a job, just to make a living and make both ends meet, then your motivation is about money, of course, and about keeping that job. But when you grow into the second layer that Martin Seligman described, which is the career, which is where most of our listeners probably are in, and that is when you bring to bear your education, your expert skills, and try to bring them into a job that grows from job to job into becoming a bigger job where you can shape your working environment, then this motivation turns from the extrinsic motivation of money and compensation into a more intrinsic one, described very well by Daniel Pink. And that is basically made of three pillars. One is mastery, one is autonomy, and one is purpose. Now, if you have specific skills, whether it's as a carpenter or as an accountant, and the job challenges them to bring the best out of you, just by doing a very good job is highly satisfying. The second item is autonomy. And every one of us has a different degree of needs of autonomy. Somebody who's signing up for a job in the army knows from scratch that their autonomy will be more limited than somebody acting as an entrepreneur. But that is your choice. But we know that if we're being micromanaged every day by a hysterical boss who sends you 485 WhatsApps during a weekend, and that is a real case I recently had of a chairman sending 485 WhatsApps to one of his CEOs during a weekend, that makes life miserable. I bet, and we can check it out, that the CEO will quit his job very, very soon because this is not a condition you want to work in. And then finally, and this has been increased by COVID, it is important to understand why you're doing this job. And here I'd like to frame it. Yes, it is about making the world better. Yes, it is to give people from different backgrounds better opportunities. But purpose can be sometimes a very simple one. And here I'd like to share a story of a visit to a gas station on a German autobahn a couple of years ago with my kids and my wife. The smallest one was 1 year old, and my wife went to change his diapers, and I was waiting with the other, who was then 5 years old, in front of the toilets. And the toilet lady spoke to us, and she asked us, well, I have a question. How did you find the toilets? And, you know, we were puzzled by being addressed. And my son said, well, normally toilets stink. They had a good smell here, like in a wood. And then he looked questioningly at me and said, Daddy, you have to say something as well. And I said, well, I found them very clean. But now I have a question to you. Why are you asking us this? And this lady answered in a remarkable way. She said, my husband is a truck driver, and he has two reasons or criteria to stop at a gas station. The first is to find a good sausage, have a snack in between. And the second is to have clean toilets. And I would like to make sure that when he and his fellow truck drivers come to this place, they feel well and they come back to our gas station. So there you can see, Record, that a purpose can also have an apparently smaller scope. But if you look at these elements, how to drive performance through strength, how we learn and how you motivate people, then you can reach better performance and you enable your people to get the best out of them and increase the performance and have a happier and better workplace and a more competitive environment. Well, then we come to the most difficult part, which is empowerment. And that means giving power away. Now, why should I, who I fought so hard to become a big manager, why should I give my power away now that I finally got it? I tell you why. There are a couple of reasons. Some reasons relate to your stakeholders, if you want, starting to your staff, and the others relate to your own life. Now, let's start with customers or employees. Why should they get power from you? Because the first thing is the acceleration of knowledge. 1950, the medical knowledge doubled every 50 years. Presently, 2023, the medical knowledge is doubled after 73 days. Every 73 days, we have twice as much medical knowledge on this planet. That is why also artificial intelligence is so used for it. So you can't cope with the acceleration of knowledge if you rely on your brain only. You need the brains of others. And you can't simply tell people, think with me, if they don't have a responsibility and if they don't carry responsibility and are participating in the successes. And that's why you have to give away power. And that is one of the reasons why we should do it. A second reason is that you're much better in framing your working environment into a learning organization than just into an execution organization. And to do that, you have to provide psychological safety. You have to make sure that even the shyest person of your staff may voice her concerns or his ideas in order to contribute to bettering the organization. And this is also a way to give power. Instead of using the power of fear and the power of punishment or public blaming, make sure that you always ask after a presentation that you give, am I missing something? Mm-hmm. And let room for others to intervene, to help and to support and integrate the things. And you will find out that by doing that, by delegating power, you will be able to multiply the efforts. Just think of the old way to delegate. You would have a meeting with a CEO, and at the same time, the CFO has asked to see you as well. Now, you can't double and clone your body, so you ask Joe to attend the meeting with the CFO. And you tell Joe, look, Joe, if you talk to the CFO, two things. Don't accept any budget cuts at our budget, and don't accept any job cuts if you discuss with them. All the rest you can discuss very freely. Now you go to the, Joe goes to the CFO, and suddenly the CFO says, well, you know, you've seen in the room, we have all the other department heads, and we've decided that we're not going to budgets for every single department. We're going to share our budgets and going to decide which are the biggest priorities in every single department. Now, Joe, what is the most important priority in your department? Well, you haven't briefed Joe on that. You haven't empowered him on that. You haven't given him the allowance to voice it. So Joe is quiet, and the CFO says, well, tell your boss next time he's going to be here because it was totally useless to have you here. This is demotivating for Joe, and it's not fostering the decision-making process of the company. So make sure that Joe gets the power to do it. Now, here comes a big objection. Well, if I give him the power to decide, and he screws up, and he makes the wrong comment and the wrong decision, what's going to happen? Yes, this is important. We have to learn how to deal with failures. And good companies, and you know we have the failure days, well, they actually have another name that I wouldn't want to mention myself, but where you have days where you share the big failures. And so you have to establish a failure culture. And I can tell you, Recker, what the failure culture, the ideal one is, because it changes from company to company, from department to department. I had a heart stroke 4 years ago, and I take 11 drugs every day. Among them, there is a blood thinner. Now, imagine my blood thinner contains arsenic, and I die. And my wife goes to Bayer, the company producing aspirin, and says, oh, my husband died because of your aspirin. And Bayer answers, oh, I'm so sorry. We have a Pareto principle of 80-20. We decided that our failure culture is that 20% of the drugs may be wrong and 80% have to be right. Well, they're going to be sued to death because with drugs and pharmaceuticals, you can't have a failure culture of 80-20. You have to have a failure culture of 100% perfection. But this may be totally different in other areas. And there are two tricks to use for a good failure culture. The first is the rules, the do's and don'ts, how to deal with a failure, how to raise your hand, who raises the hand, who detects the failure and so forth, have to be mutually agreed between the boss and the team and the whole team. That's the first one. And the second one is, once you've established the rules on failure, make sure you're the first to claim a mistake. Lead by example. Because if you don't do that, nobody's going to start to test the new rules and they're going to be scared. And now let's come to the advantages that you have. Now, with a complex world, with a world that has been described as very volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous, and if you don't want to look at the theoretical abbreviation of the acronym of VUCA, look at what happened during COVID. That's a typical VUCA phenomenon, where you can't predict things. You need time to think, to reflect, to check whether the strategy is rightly implemented. And as a leader, you need to foster relationships and care for relationships with the major stakeholders in order to listen to them, to make sure that in times of crisis, these relationships are resilient. And even if you have a conflict, you can manage that. And to do that, you have to have time available. And you have every year, there's a new program, customer focus this year, and it is on top of performance management program last year. Plus, you have to reach your goals. It's getting increasingly complex. And if you don't find the time, an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, half a day, a week, in order to reflect about these things, to take time to listen to your people, then you will not be able to cope with all this workload. And you will work weekends and send or receive 485 WhatsApp messages. This is wrong. And in order to make that room available, that space that is necessary for good leadership, where your brain can work and your relations can be put to leverage, then you need time. And this is only possible if you give away power. And let me give you a second good reason for you, your health. If you want to look at your own balance, you have to be healthy. Think of the recommendations of airlines. If you're sitting next to children and the oxygen masks come out, first put an oxygen mask on yourself in order to be able to help your child and then put the oxygen mask on them. So think about your own health and your own balance. And there's a rule in monkey management. Imagine that scene. You have tasked Kevin with filling out an Excel sheet, an easy exercise. You've even given Kevin a week to do that. Now, you're going out of your office to go through the CEO's office, and you know it takes exactly 3 minutes to get there, and it's 3 to 5, and you have to be there at 5 o'clock. And once you get out, Kevin catches you, says, "Hey, boss." And already the "hey, boss" lasts 7 seconds. So you're losing your time. You're getting impatient. Said, "What's up, Kevin?" And he's waving the Excel sheet in front of you. "Look here, the numbers don't add up. And I just, can't find." And you see you're getting late. You take this Excel sheet out of Kevin's hands. And you say, "Well, I'll do it, okay?" And you take it away because you know you'll do it in 20 minutes. Now, what you've done this moment, you've accepted the monkey. If you accept 2 monkeys a day, in 2 years, you will have a burnout. So it is in your interest and the interest of the growth of Kevin that you give away power and responsibility.
To round off our conversation, you do a lot of work besides this excellent book that you've published. You do a lot of work around leadership and equipping leaders. Can you tell us more about the other activities you're involved with?
Well, I'm a one-trick pony. I'm just not gifted with neither a high IQ nor many skills. But I try to put the little trick that I have into different vessels. So I love teaching at university, and therefore this is one of my activities. And I have founded a leadership academy providing training through world-class people. We're talking about greenwashing as one of the items that managers have to be very mindful to establish their credibility. If you have a person who's been head of Greenpeace International for 11 years and who sets the agenda of the G20 meetings on climate, then you have somebody very credible. And I was able to convince a couple of people in my network to be trainers at this academy, and we have a master class every year that I do in Umbria, which is in central Italy, where I have a country house, so that I can combine the bliss of being in my home country, enjoying the beauty of the landscape, with peer learning, and not only teaching but also learning from them with great fireside chats under an old oak. Then I'm an executive coach. I've done a training at Marla Kempel in London, which is one of the best coaching schools on this planet, and I'm gifted with very, very good clients who are sharing their challenges, and I try to support them, making them grow, and it is really a wonderful feeling to see people grow and solve their problems with their own strengths and their own talents. And that is why half of the time that I devote to executive coaching, I don't bill for. And I have stopped calling it pro bono work, because actually that would be a lie. Because this is not pro bono. It's not for the good. It's for me. It's very egotistic. You know, if you're coaching a person in jail who's preparing to get out of jail and start a new life, then you're learning so many things about what conditions are out there. Or if you talk to a middle manager who cannot afford my high fees, you understand about their sandwich position between top management and employees. And all these learnings are very useful for my interaction with a C-suite, with a C-level people. And therefore, it is clearly benefiting me. And most of the cases, these people benefit from this conversation, not because I'm particularly good, but because at least I listen to them and I can put them into contact with other people, and that is the peer learning part, that can learn from each other. Then I'm mentoring startup companies because I love the enthusiasm of young people building something that may benefit society. So these are lots of things that I'm doing, but basically catering to one goal, and that is to make the world of business a little bit more mindful of the needs and the expectations of society, of employees, of customers, and investors, so that what we do can, it's a big world, but can contribute to a slightly better world, even if it's just in a micro environment. And there I'm very humble. I'm just a grain of sand in a huge beach. But I think everybody has to leverage his or her talents. And the few talents I have, I want to leverage to give my little contribution. And if at the end of the day, I helped some people, this makes me happy.
Well, that's excellent, Emilio. Thank you. Thank you for making a difference. From what you just mentioned there, I can see that you have a very big impact across, everyone that you help and that everyone that comes in contact with you, including myself. Thank you so much for speaking with me today. It's been lovely to have you as a guest, and very insightful Thanks again. It was lovely having you on the podcast.
And just to be consistent, Requia, if the listeners to this podcast are interested to hear more, I have a question, I have a challenge, I can't promise that I will answer it. I can't promise I will provide a solution, but I can promise I will reply. So if under the podcast you'll put my website, people can contact me through the contact function on my website, and I promise I'll answer within a reasonable time to your messages if you have any questions or challenges or discussion points or complaints and critiques about what I said.
No, that's excellent, Emilio. I'll definitely share the link to your website as well as the details of your book with listeners, and I'm sure they'll be in touch. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Requia. It was a really nice conversation. Thank you.
And that's a wrap for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. Please leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Until next time, happy listening.